someone stood up and was like, well, oh yes, well, that's all very well for you, but I'm an environmental charity and this won't work for me.
Yeah.
And I remember you and I looked at each other and we were like, well, I'm here talking about funding abortions and Simon's talking about, you know, fundraising for counseling for sexual abusers. Like, yeah. Think of two more unpopular causes, I dare you. And, you know, if we can make it work, then you can make it work. People think the grass is always greener.
You're listening to Simon Scriver's amazingly ultimate fundraising superstar podcast, talking all things fundraising, charities, nonprofits, and more. Here's your host, as always, Simon Scriver.
If you've seen me speak before, you've probably heard me quote this woman today. Her name is Keelan Appleby, and the quote of hers that I love, that I always use in all of my workshops, is the things that matter most to your donors don't depend on big budgets and lots of staff. And so I wanted to delve more into that and more into her whole approach to donors and some of the research she's done. And so today I have with me Keelan Appleby. Hello, Keelan.
Hello, Simon.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah? Yes, I'm good.
Thank you very much for coming on this podcast for absolutely, honestly, the first time and not, we didn't fuck up the recording.
Never seen before.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So this is a complete premiere.
Yeah.
Keelan, who are you?
I'm a strategy director at Ask Direct in Dublin. So I work with our clients here to work on their strategies and their tactics. So thinking long-term, what they need to be doing, what their goals are, what their goals should be and how they need to make those happen.
And you're kind of responsible for the blogging and the newsletter from Ask Direct. You put out some really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it's not only me, but it is at the moment mostly me. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So it's fun. I mean, I enjoy writing a blog post.
And your perception or your view often seems to be centered around what donors want and what they actually want and what they're going through. And I love that kind of stuff. This is obviously a big part of your business.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it feels like, so I wrote a blog post because I was in Scotland. When was I in Scotland? I want to say October or November, speaking to a small group from the IOF, mm-hmm. Scotland. And I was talking about kind of small charities, which is obviously a drum that you bang as well. We've been known to play together at conferences.
Yeah.
So I was talking about small charities and how they can make the most of kind of the giving cycle, you know, asking, thanking and feeding back properly. And one guy, you know, guy there quite rightly asked me, you know, we've been talking about this as a sector for a long time and why are we still so bad at it? So I wrote a whole blog about that because I was like, yeah, you're right. You know, we get sick of saying it often, you know, as an agency and as fundraisers to the wider charity, like we need to be taking care of our donors properly. And we've been saying it decades, like how long ago did relationship fundraising come out, which is like, you know, mm-hmm. the text, and yet we're still not getting it right.
And why is that? Why do, when we go to conferences, people are still saying send a thank you letter within 48 hours?
Yeah.
How is that not kind of canon now?
Yeah, I know. I think, well, what I wrote about in that post is I think people are looking for what Tom Ahern calls the shiny new thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time this comes from outside the fundraising department as well. So maybe it's the board or maybe it's the chief executive who isn't a fundraiser. You know, they're like, let's, you know, we need to improve our fundraising. We need to do something new.
Mm.
And actually most improvement, most of the time in any industry, not just fundraising, but it comes from making incremental changes with big effects.
Mm-hmm.
So in that blog post, I made an analogy to powerlifting, which is another passion of mine of, you know, there are no quick fixes most of the time. To get better at something, to get stronger at something, you need to do it over and over again and you tweak something small and you do that and you say, okay, well, now that I've tweaked that, I can mm-hmm. do this change. But there's no, you can't walk in to a gym and expect to go from squatting the bar to squatting your body weight with no training or any incremental change in between.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I talk about in that blog post is people just don't believe that doing simple things well over and over again can have such an effect.
Yeah.
We're constantly chasing, you know, what's new, what's innovative. Let's do lead gen and not talk to our direct mail donors, you know.
Yeah.
It's frustrating. It's and I think as well that another factor related to that is we're still really bad at long-term tracking and long-term thinking. We're focused on, you know, a lot of the time we're focused on what are we doing this year, not what are we doing in the next 5 or 10 years as fundraisers. Even if the organization might be have a five-year plan, fundraising isn't part of it. Fundraising's just given it afterwards and said, okay, now you have to fund the money to do this because that's what we've decided. So all of these things have long-term effects, and you'll see those when you're able to track long-term. But if you don't have the database set up in a way that enables you to do that, if you don't have anyone in your charity who can work your database to show you the lifetime value of people who are properly thanked and properly fed back to you over time, you're not going to see the effect, and therefore you're going to go for the thing that gives you the best campaign ROI, even if it isn't the thing that gives you the best lifetime value.
It feels like that sometimes like the incremental changes and the stuff, a lot of the stuff you talk about doesn't always feel like it lines up with the mission. So the mission is a big thing. You know, you're trying to change the world, you're trying to end world hunger, you're trying to bring in all these services in. And do we sometimes shy away from the small incremental retention changes, the donor care, because it's like, well, this isn't going to blow the world away.
Yeah.
This isn't a nice bucket challenge. This isn't big and exciting that everyone's going to get involved in. Is there like a misalignment with what you're doing well and what's working for you and your clients? Is it misaligned with what we feel is worlds changing?
Yeah, I think so. I think that goes back to what I mean about the shiny new thing. And bringing the mission into that as well makes sense. And often there is that kind of gap between the mission-focused people in a charity and the fundraisers. And then there's also another gap a lot of the time between the people who work for a charity and what they think about their mission and what the donors know and think and believe and about the mission and are inspired by. And a lot of the time, you know, you are not your audience. The type of people who work in charity fundraising are not the type of people necessarily who are responding to your direct mail, certainly. And a lot of the time, a lot of your other fundraising as well. So, you know, me as a woman in my 30s, I might look at something and go, oh, that's, you know, I'm not going to respond to that, but that doesn't matter. You know, it's not me who's responding to that. It's my mother, it's my grandmother, it's my grandfather who are getting out their checkbooks.
Do you own a checkbook?
I don't. I think the last time I owned a checkbook was when I worked in the States for a summer.
Yeah.
And then for some reason they gave us all checkbooks.
Well, they're big into checks in America.
Yeah. I don't know. I almost kept it as a memento, but then I couldn't make it work with the weight of my bag.
This seems to be like one of your skills. You know, the impression that I always get that makes you an excellent fundraiser is this skill of knowing what donors want, or at least not assuming you know what donors want.
Yeah.
There's two strands to it. I think one, I always get the impression that you have a bit of intuition, which I want to ask you about, and maybe you disagree with. But the other side of it is the research side of it. And you spend a lot of time and energy actually researching what donors really want compared to maybe what we assume they want or what they say they want even.
Yeah.
So you published some research, or you started to share kind of snippets of research you did with Blue Frog.
Yeah.
About what donors actually want in Ireland compared to other types of donors.
Yeah.
How did that go for you?
That was really interesting. I mean, research side is really something I'm passionate about. I'm a big nerd. I have a master's degree in cognitive science. I like digging into papers and seeing what's going on. And so, the research we did with Blue Frog last summer was actually the second in a research program that we did jointly with Blue Frog. So the first one was looking at Blue Frog were particularly interested in mid-value donors. So I think that was done in 2016 or 2017. And then last year we were looking at specifically core donors. So that's the kind of the 80% of the file. The people who are giving you, you know, your 10 euro, 15 euro a month regular gifts, the people who are giving you, you know, 50 quid every couple of campaigns.
Yeah.
Those people, you know.
Not the major donors, not the outliers.
Not the major donors and not the mid-level donors. It's the ones that, like I say, we use the Pareto principle here a lot in AskDirect. So, you know, 20% of your income comes from 80% of your donors and 80% of your income comes from 20% of your donors. So we were focusing on this research on the 80% of donors who are the majority of the files, but perhaps don't give as much proportionally.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, it was part of a wider research in a few countries that Blue Frog were doing, and it's useful for us as an agency based in Ireland with mostly Irish clients to see what the differences are, because when I go to research, a lot of the research that's out there and is available is based in the US or based in the UK. You know, we are a really, really small market and there's not that much Irish information out there.
Yeah.
I mean, when we did the most recent fundraising school event on the legacy market in Ireland, really scrabbling around to try to find reliable figures
on imagine.
What the market is like. And you're relying on a few different sources who themselves are all relying on charity self-reported data or annual reports. You kind of, you're making a reasonable estimate, but it's still not robust.
Yeah.
So for us, it was really important that we have a sense of, you know, because we're relying on, you know, when we bring in research insights into our work, we're relying on stuff that's done in the UK being applicable here.
Mm-hmm.
And people in the UK, generalizing here, but many people in the UK assume Ireland is just a smaller, greener version of the UK that likes potatoes more. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we have in common with the UK, language mostly included, but there are differences as well. And it's the differences that we were particularly interested in uncovering, well, that I find particularly interesting when we wrote it up.
Because you're a fundraiser who has worked many years in the UK and many years in Ireland.
Mm.
And is it a different, beyond size, how different a market is it? Or how different is a donor?
Well, that was one of the questions that we were trying to answer, actually. I think definitely donors, you know, have more in common than they have, you know, than they are. More in common than they are different.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things, apart from size, one of the things that I always found very strange as an Irish person was the heritage and military charities in the UK.
Yeah.
And the power of their brands.
Yeah.
And, you know, because we don't have that same... So Ashley Rothone from Legacy Voice, who was over to co-present the Legacy session with me, he was talking about the kind of the biggest charities from a legacy giving point of view, and brand is huge in legacy giving.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, you know, the third largest charity in legacy giving is the RNLI. He was like, I don't know why.
Mm.
Heritage charity. Mm. Just people have this, like, but we don't have the same, I think because we don't have the same longevity of charity giving, perhaps as a culture.
Mm-hmm.
While we're very charitable, we don't, as institutions, as something that's separate from the church, we perhaps don't have the same cultural longevity. So I found out that's one of my first clients when I moved to London to work for Blue Frog was a military charity. And I found their stuff very strange. You know, they had a message from the Prince of Wales on the back of all of their response forms. And I was like, oh, this is, you know,
yeah,
this is very different.
I find like military charities are fascinating because I mean, and maybe we have to be careful here, but I would personally never give to one.
Yeah.
Not that I wholly object to them, but there's just so many other things I would rather give to.
Yeah.
And just sometimes the way they're presented seems completely foreign to me because, I'm Irish. I grew up in Hong Kong and it's just, I've never kind of had that level of it. There's one charity whose logo, I'm not sure if it still is, and it was like a guy on a stretcher, like
Help
a soldier
for
on a
stretcher.
Help for Heroes.
Yes.
And he's giving a thumbs up.
Yes.
And for me, I mean, I don't know how offensive that is to kind of laugh at that, but it was just so bizarre. You know, I've never seen, but for a lot of people over there, it really resonates.
Yeah. And it means something,
Do they look back at us? Do the English look at us and look at our church giving? Is that something that's foreign to them? Because we love the church.
I don't think they think about us that much.
Well, as the Brexit stuff has really shown.
As the most recent events have shown. And as an Irish person living in the UK, when the original referendum was happening, and Irish people, by the way, have votes in the UK in general elections and in referenda. So, as someone in a kind of, as an Irish person, you were in a really unique position as in, an immigrant and a foreigner who nevertheless had a vote. Few of them did. It was a very, very odd place to be. But yes, no, I don't think the UK thinks about us all that much, really. But I liked what you said about the church, because I think that is possibly the perception here that, you know, Irish people are giving because of a religious sense of duty. And actually, you know, the religion, like what the research was kind of showing to us was the religion is in there, but it's more complicated and perhaps more subtle than stereotypes would suggest. It's not that people are giving because they're tithing to the church in a way, or they believe that Jesus wants them to. You know, it's not Irish people are quite, as much as a religion is a huge cultural thing here, it's not, we're quite reticent, we're quite self-effacing about actually our talking about our religious values and our religious beliefs, I think. And what came through in the research when we asked people about that, like why, and it was general, you know, the kind of we started with general questions about their attitudes about charitable giving before we got into their attitudes about their particular charities. You know, why do you give to charity? A lot of the answers that came back had a religious influence, and it was, you know, it was the nuns always taught us that there are four pillars to your life, you know, your family and your work and your social, what we would now call social justice, but they kind of called charitable work.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman who I'm thinking particularly of, she said, and I've always held to that. But then you would ask them, you know, do you give to religious charities or do you go to church? And they would be like, ah, no, you know, once a year, Christmas, you know, no, yeah. I'm not a believer anymore.
Yeah.
There was one or two people who said, yes, and this, I'm consciously choosing religious charities because they are aligning with my values. But most people, where the religion influenced them, it influenced them in their childhood, and they viewed it as part of a social duty that we all shared. And it was that view of it that came from religious ethos, but it wasn't that they were giving because it was a religious belief of theirs. There's a difference there. It's not because the church is telling you to. It's because it was part of your social, your social worldview to charity.
To a certain extent, it's hardwired into you because you've been raised in that environment, or you've taken some of the elements out of that religious upbringing. I mean, if I think back to being raised as a Catholic, you know, going to mass every Sunday, it obviously sticks with you. Even if you turn your back on some of the church elements, there's still that. That's still the way you were raised, and you can't shake that.
A lot of people referenced school and how charitable giving was woven into school life as well. Mm. Now, obviously, you know, the vast majority of schools in Ireland were and are religiously owned. And so you have things like, you know, the Troker Box at Lent was a school thing, and the Concerned Fast was a school thing. But I also remember the MS Readathon from primary school. Like, a lot of
reading the Bible.
No. I you can read whatever you like as long as you
read
put
the Bible.
It down. I particularly like Leviticus. That's the funniest one. But that came through a lot as well, that sense of, you know, it's just something that we do as Irish people. That's what we should do.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So it's much more subtle than I think people perhaps from the outside. Like when you go back and look at the referendum last year, a lot of the foreign commentary and even some of the Irish commentary, and they should have known better, you know, was like, whoa, this is so terribly surprising. Ireland is, you know, 90% Catholic and they've just legalized abortion. Isn't that a shock? It turns upside down. Everything we thought we knew about Irish society is like, guys, have you been paying attention? You know, have you ever lived in Ireland or spoken to an Irish person raised Catholic? Like, it's much more complicated than that.
It is. It can be very confusing from the outside, or when you try to explain it from the outside. I mean, if I think about my friends, my circle of Irish friends, I would say none of them are religious and none of them kind of practice Catholicism anymore, but they all had church weddings. I think all of them except one had a church wedding. They all got their children baptized.
Yeah.
And that actually doesn't seem strange until you actually say it out loud or explain. It's like the other thing is Tato Park. It's nothing to do with religion, but that doesn't seem strange until you explain to an English person, our big theme park is based around potatoes.
Crisps.
There's that element. And I suppose that's part of this research, is it that you're actually vocalizing it a little bit or putting it on paper? Suddenly realize, or you try and add it off a little bit?
And I think it's helped us as well when it comes to, you know, there was five charities who participated in the research, but it's helped us when we're shaping our communications for all of our clients, really. I mean, if you are a religious charity, what this research is telling us is you can dial it up a little more, you know, even if your staff or none of your staff are really religious, but if you have a charity with a religious ethos, and if you have people who are working for you who are religious, then don't be afraid to put them front and center. Like, you don't have to be ashamed of your religious ethos if that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, I don't think Colin from Chogru will mind me saying this, but we've seen really good response when we started dialing that religion up a little bit in our communications, you know, or, you know, putting a nun on the outer envelope. And she's, you know, we didn't, it's not a stock image of a nun, it's a real nun. But, you know, she's out there doing the work, and we decided, okay, well, she's out there doing the work. Let's, you know, we have the backing from this research to say, okay, donors are comfortable with this.
Yeah.
But it's not American style, you know, if Jesus leads you, you know, we want you to pray about this. And if Jesus leads you to make a gift, it's not evangelical. And I think Irish people from this research certainly would be very uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
But it's about being, you know, just, you don't have to hide it.
Yeah.
If it's there, use it. But then for our, for our other clients, I mean, most of our clients aren't religious charities or don't have a religious ethos. It's about building that sense of, you know, it's not, we talk a lot about, you know, in fundraising, having that one-to-one conversation, you know, the letter is from one person to one person. And actually what this research is suggesting to us is Irish people are, they don't perhaps see themselves as just one person against the world. It's, they see themselves as part of a community of people acting. Certainly these core donors do. It's different for major donors, and it's a little bit different for mid-level donors as well. But so we're trying to bring in more language about, you know, you as part of a community, as part of a group of people who all share the same values. And we're seeing some good responses from that as well. So where we're not just addressing the donor as a single person alone, trying to affect this change, it's saying to them, you know, you are a part of a group, a community. When you move outside fundraising and talk about movement building, and Damien spoken a lot about this, you know, you talk about someone as part of a movement, as part of a wave of change. And people seem to respond to that. You know, they don't, these type of donors, you know, they don't want to be the big fish in a small pond. They want to feel like they're one of many.
Part of something?
Yeah. And I think it goes back to, you know, some of the research around social proofing and making donors feel like this is the, or tapping into the feeling they probably already have that this is the expected normal thing to do, but also adding to that. And it's not just normalizing, it's actually calling it back to values that we as a community share. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah. And it you know, it makes me think of the church again, because of a huge part of the church in Ireland is a community feeling. Like I even feel like, I'm not necessarily thinking about my mom, but thinking about other people of her generation who still go to church. They maybe disagree with a lot of what's said or what's happened, but they go every Sunday or every day, even because it's their community. It's their group.
And none of us want to be lonely. And that goes back to your point about weddings and christenings, is a lot of your friends probably are doing that, not because they fervently believe that they need a church wedding, but it's because that's what people in their community do. And that's what their local school is, where their children is a Catholic school. So yeah, it's that, it's, you know, as human beings, we have rituals, and rituals are very powerful. And for most Irish people, most of the time, the rituals that have are most common and have the most meaning for them are Catholic rituals, because that's what we've all been doing for a long time. But I mean, I think I don't want to overstate the religious kind of conclusions from this research, because it was just kind of one of the many things that we kind of came out with.
Yeah. I think it's just, it's always interesting to talk about religion, or you always kind of fall back because there's undertones of religion in everything.
Yeah.
You know, even if you think you're avoiding it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a comedian who is now shunned, but said, it's like, what year is it? Mm-hmm. You know, it's 2019 AD. It's like, it's still built around like Christ.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
even when we change it to BCE and CE. Yeah.
You made some of these calls yourself to the donors, so you actually had some of the conversations?
Yes. So we had four people calling, myself, Nadrina from here and Ask Direct, and then Amber and Honey from Blue Frog.
And was there anything else that, I mean, how was that experience? How do you like talking to donors?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's always good to have your assumptions checked.
Yeah.
And you have to be, you have to be careful, you know, allow a little bit of silence, and they'll often fill it, you know, not just jump in there. You have to, these kind of one-on-one qualitative things, like we have a topic guide and we have questions that we want to hit, but it's very important to make the conversation feel natural.
Yeah.
And let the donor go where they want to go. And so you as an interviewer have to be a good, you know, active listening, but also going, okay, well, they've covered that. And then they've covered, oh, this one from the page 3 of my topic guide.
Yeah.
Now we're bouncing back to page 1. So
they don't follow your script.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's a very good lesson. And, you know, I know this intellectually, but it's always good to get the reminder from someone of, you know, donor, these type of donors don't think as much about charities as we do.
Yeah.
You know, we're working 9 to 5, you know, if you're lucky, all day, every day, on charity stuff, and they just, they aren't, they've got other stuff. You know, a lot of donors said to me things like, you know, sure, oh, well, all charities are the same.
Yeah.
Or having trouble, you know, when I got their information, for example, as part of a certain charity's file, and ring them and asking them, you know, at some point in the conversation, why did you first start supporting this charity?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, I can't remember. No idea. You know, was it an ad? And I know the charity has never done a TV ad or hasn't done one in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
They don't remember.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And they don't, you know, they don't differentiate. Like, a lot of them had trouble differentiating between different homelessness charities, for example. So they don't think about it as much as we do.
Yeah.
But I think what it helped with is, you know, I think it's that quote, is it by Maya Angelou? It's like, people will forget what you did and they will forget what you said, but they'll never forget how you made them feel.
Have you forgotten the quote?
Yeah. I think I'm paraphrasing. I might be paraphrasing. But that's it. You know, it's like, they don't remember which pack they responded to 3 years ago. A lot of the time, they don't remember which pack they most recently gave to, if they gave to direct mail.
Yeah.
But they remember things like, they gave me a phone call and they were very nice. Or conversely, you know, they rang me up and I felt pressured. They do remember things like that. And it really brought home one of the other main things that I took away from this, is the real importance of donor care.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the contrasts for Irish donors as opposed to elsewhere. And if you've ever, I don't know if you've seen Mark from Blue Frog presenting this research, but if you have, one of the favorite things he said when he presented it first was, he just kind of looked at the audience and he was like, you guys are just nicer than we are.
Do the accent. Irish people are so nice.
I would never dare. I'm not doing impressions of Mark. I used to work for him. I'm still too scared. I know. But that was interesting as well. It's like, their donor care expectations were lower than UK donors.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't,
they again, tolerated more.
They were much more forgiving, and they were they didn't want to be seen to be asking for anything, almost.
Hmm.
You know, and these are core donors. So they are older people. They, you know, they said things like, you know, when we asked them about what communications they like and value, and probed about thank you letters or newsletters or that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
they would say things like, oh, you know, I'm sure the staff are very busy and they have better things to be doing now than writing me a thank you letter.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's fine. But at the same time, the charity in the sample with the best donor care had the best, most loyal donors.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and they said things like, you know, they remembered the thank you letters, probably even more than the appeals. They said, oh yes, they invited me in and that was lovely and I've been on a tour. Or they would say things like, no, they've invited me in several times and I do intend to go. I haven't gotten around to it, but I will go in now sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
One of those donors said to me, oh, you know, sure, if you so much as made them a cup of tea, they'd write you a lovely thank you card.
Mm.
So they do really remember, because their expectations are low, they do really remember what we as professional fundraisers would consider basic donor care.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't feel basic to them.
Mm-hmm.
It feels really special.
They get, I mean, Irish people are subject to pretty shitty customer care from companies and stuff. And I think, you know, what you're saying there is really interesting about when people think we're too busy to do this stuff, that there's like a flip side to that if you do it, it's really noticed. Because like, well, God, they're so busy and they still made the time to write me this letter.
So, and we know from our other research, so we've done a lot of, with Donor Voice, we've done a lot of donor commitment surveys with our clients, and consistently, you know, where we look at what are all the different drivers of loyalty,
mm-hmm.
What correlates, what kinds of contacts that donors have with you drive their loyalty and their value to you. And you it's very interesting to see, like, you know, and you can calculate then for the client the difference between, okay, well, if you convert 10% of your low loyalty donors to high loyalty donors, this is what's going to earn you over 5 years. It's lots of charts and slides. I love it. But consistently, I think we've done this kind of for 7 clients now, consistently the top 10 drivers of donor loyalty are donor care experiences. So it's things like, can I get my query answered? Am I thanked properly? It's what we, again, going back to our earlier conversations, what we consider the basics. So on the phone, they were saying things to us like, oh, I don't expect much. Yet they really remembered good donor care. And then from our other types of research, we know that that good donor care experiences directly correlate with loyalty and value. So yeah, that was probably the other big takeaway, was the difference in how they consciously think about donor care versus other countries, and then how they consciously think about donor care versus what we know from other Irish research.
Let me ask you this and bring it back to kind of the beginning where we were talking about small charities. And I've asked a couple podcast guests this recently, because someone tweeted at me that about donor love and about donor care and all these things that we're always harping on about. And they were essentially saying that if you're a big organization, it kind of goes out the window because it's not possible, you know, and I'm paraphrasing it to make it sound worse, but essentially they're saying, you know, that's all well and good for a small organization to do handwritten thank yous, to do these lovely phone calls, to invite them in for a cup of tea. But if you're a big organization, get real, Keelan. Why? What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's a question of processes and priorities. Yeah, it's like, at what point in the growth from being a small charity to being a big charity did you decide that donor care wasn't as important as all the other snazzy things you could be doing? Why? Why is that? Like, surely you have the research. Yeah, you might have to automate things a little more, but surely you have the resources to pick up the phone to a few donors, even if they're, you know, the ones who gave 3 times more than you asked them for, or the ones who gave an exceptional gift. And I know from one of my clients is one of Ireland's largest charities, and they've made great improvements in donor care and thanking through really simple, really, really simple things. And if small charities can do it and large charities can do it, it's really a question of priorities. It's like, where are you? Why did you decide that doing this wasn't important when all the research and your donors are probably telling you that it is?
Because your resources have grown as you've grown as an organization. So you've made a choice.
Yeah.
You've made a choice of where to put that.
Yeah. You're always making choices. I mean, that's one of the things I try to get across talking about strategy. It's strategy is not only thinking about what do we need to do, but what do we need to not do? What are we going to stop? You know, stop, start, change. Like, what are we stopping doing in order to start doing other stuff?
Yeah.
Because a lot of the times charities want, or people come and they have this idea in their head. They're like, okay, I want to do this big project. And you're like, okay, well, what's your budget? And they're like, well, we're going to have to take budget from here and here and here in order to do this. Or they're like, we want to do this and this and this and this. And you're like, well, those goals don't really chime together. So which is more important? What are you going to stop doing so that you can start doing other? And so probably what's happened there is, what have you stopped? Why did you decide to stop doing that in order to do this other thing? That's probably not, like, I mean, I'm constantly flabbergasted by, like, we did legacy mystery shopping recently, which we'll be publishing a report on that on our website. And some of the responses were just like, you wouldn't even write that to, I'm thinking of one. First of all, only 2/3 of charities responded when they were asked to send more information on legacy.
This is you mystery shopping them and asking for legacy. Okay.
Yeah. So only 2/3 of charities actually sent us what we asked for.
Okay.
Which is depressing.
Yeah.
And then some of them who did respond, I'm thinking about a healthcare charity who run healthcare facilities.
Yeah.
In their letter back to our mystery shopper, essentially said, and I'm paraphrasing, but essentially said, just because you make a legacy gift, it doesn't guarantee you a bed.
Yeah.
So you're like, okay, that may be true, but yes, I've said thank nothing. You. Yeah, thank yeah. you. I feel special.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
Great. Like, there's some really, really bad stuff out there.
That research isn't out yet.
Not yet. It's coming out. It's coming out. Yeah, we're working on it at the moment. It's going to come out end of this month or next month.
Wow. That's
But small. I mean, the grass is always greener. I mean, you know this. When we presented at summer school the first time, and you know, I was presenting about my work with ASN, which for anyone who doesn't know is an abortion funding charity, and Simon was presenting about his work with One in Four, which is, you know, for survivors of sexual abuse and perpetrators of sexual abuse and their families. Someone stood up and was like, "Well, oh yes, well that's all very well for you, but I'm an environmental charity and this won't work for me."
Yeah.
And I remember you and I looked at each other and we were like, "Well, I'm here talking about funding abortions and Simon is talking about, you know, fundraising for counseling for sexual abusers. Like, think of two more unpopular causes, I dare you. And, you know, if we can make it work, then you can make it work." People think that the grass is always greener. I think Mary Cahalan wrote a post recently about arts fundraising and you know, people say, "Oh, arts fundraisers, they have it all made. They get contact with those rich people and they have those lovely venues. They have it so easy." Yeah. And then arts fundraisers are thinking, "Oh, well, you know, we're not curing cancer or saving fluffy puppies. It's so difficult for us." Yeah. You know, everybody thinks the grass is always greener. Small charities, you know, and I've said this before, small charities think that they don't have the resources and large charities think that they don't have the time, and everybody's wrong.
Yeah. You got to work to your strengths and you got to make it work. There's a story I always tell about the cause always being greener. And it was a friend of mine who was working as head of fundraising for a children's hospice. And she took me around to see the hospice and, you know, you see all these terminally ill children. You see, you know, she showed me the room where they're laid to rest, where their family gets to see them for the last time, showed me all those facilities. And it was just like, just really beautiful. And I remember like being in tears. Mm. And I said to her, I was like, you know, this must be such a, almost like a privilege to fundraise for, you know, it must be quite easy because people want to give to this. And she looked at me and she was like, "Yeah, but it's not dogs, is it?" And yeah, I think we're all kind of fall victim to that sometimes. It's kind of thinking, looking at the challenges and the struggles as opposed to looking at what we have going for us, because we always have something going for us.
Absolutely. And like, if you have, this goes back to your original question about what donors want. Like, if there's one thing I think we could do more of is asking donors why they gave to us in the first place. Like, put a text box at the end of your donation process online, ask them why. And that they're like, because when I was volunteering for ASN, I was kind of the fundraising person on the board. I was the only one. And then thankfully we got an events fundraiser friend of mine on there as well. So there was two of us against the world. But when I started, like, that was one of the huge things we started doing was just asking donors, like, why did you give to us? And the answers we got back were not only really emotional and really touching and, you know, really brought home the privilege of being able to fundraise for this cause and help the people we were helping. But it also, it gave us content for future fundraising campaigns. And there's a campaign on Sophie, if anybody wants to Google Sophie ASN Regular Giving, there's a sample campaign on there where all the content was generated because we asked regular givers why they set up a regular gift to us. And that was the campaign. We only used their quotes. And it was the most successful regular giving campaign we've ever done.
Yeah.
And I think it's still the most successful regular giving campaign we've ever done. So not only does it, you know, it brings home to you the importance of the mission of the work, it connects you with your donors, it makes them feel valuable and that you're interested in what they're doing, but it gives you a real insight into how you can shape your communications to speak to the value that they're telling you about. And it gives you free content. Like, what's not to like?
Yeah.
Just ask them why.
Yeah. It's I mean, as an agency, you're an agency who writes a lot of copy, which is one of the hardest things in the industry. It saves you having to write copy, doesn't it? You ask people questions and they write the copy for you.
Yeah. I mean, it helps. It certainly helps, you know, and using donor quotes, it brings home the sense that you're part of this community of donors. Like, it's social proofing. It does all these amazing things. And yet people are still afraid to ask. Fundraisers are still afraid to ask their donors why, or they just don't think about it. And that was one of the things that Ashley and I in the legacy session were trying to tell people that they need to do is, as a legacy fundraiser, you need to get more stories from your people who have already raised their hands.
Yeah.
And the easiest way is to ask them what their story is, ask them why they support you.
Yeah.
And still so many people are afraid to do that. And
wow.
it just boggles my mind.
Lovely. Okay, I don't want to keep you any longer, even though this is totally the first time we've ever sat down and recorded this.
I think this time is better, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember the first time, but I think this
time is absolutely. That's right. So if people want to firstly find you, where do they find you? And if people want to find this kind of research and the stuff you're putting out, where should people go?
So
after this?
I'm on Twitter. So that's QAOILEANN, which is not how you spell my actual name, but somebody stole that. So you can
Keelan was looking up to the sky there trying to remember how to spell her own Twitter handle, which is a bad sign of a Twitter handle. So say that again, Q.
QAOILEANN.
Very good.
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn as well. And then blogs, and you can is askdirect.ie/blog. And you can also sign up to our email newsletter on there as well, where we signpost to blogs, we talk about other events and stuff we're doing. So yeah, those are probably the main places for me.
Thank you. And I will link to all of them in the podcast description. Final question for you is, how much do you bench press?
Oh, my best bench press is 67.5 kilos, which is not very much.
Well, that's good.
But it is more than body weight, so, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay.
All right, listen, thank you very much for joining me. That was really good. And I hope we can speak again when your next set of research and that mystery shopping stuff comes out, because that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you very much, Keelan.
Thanks, Simon.
You've been listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and head over to changefundraising.com to learn more or get in touch with Simon. Or don't. Whatever. You're big enough to make your own decisions.
Hello. This is Morgan Freeman. For discounts on Simon's best-selling online fundraising courses, go to www.changefundraising.com/training and use coupon code podcast. Complete them in your own time, wherever you want. Get busy living or get busy buying.